Thank you for tuning in to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of pod conversations about current trends and issues in Africa. I'm Heba Habib, and sitting next to me is my colleague Henrik Alfredsson, who will introduce today's episode.
In many African countries, women in politics are on the rise. In the 2020 Ghana elections, we saw the appointment of Nana Opoku-Agyemang, the first ever woman running mate for one of the two main presidential candidates. And in the Kenya elections last fall, we saw the same thing with Raila Odinga's deputy candidate, Martha Karua, as the first woman to run for a political ticket of a major political party. Parallel with more women in top positions, we also see a slow but steady general trend towards more women in politics at both national and local levels across the continent, but not everywhere. In last year's parliamentary by-elections in Zimbabwe, only 14% of the contestants were women, and they won only 5 out of 28 seats. There are also other worrying trends. 45 out of Africa's 53 countries have gender quotas of some kind. But in many cases, they could be described as symbolic window dressing. And violence against women in politics poses a serious threat to women's political inclusion and citizenship in many African countries. With us here to discuss these issues are Diana Höjlund-Madsen, a senior researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute, Sheila Sintoya-Memusi, a political analyst with a focus on feminist institutionalism, and Manditsa Parikh, lecturer at Midlands State University in Gweru, Zimbabwe. Diana, Sheila, and Manditsa have done research on women's political representation in Ghana, Kenya, and Zimbabwe.
Welcome, ladies. We're delighted to have you all. So our first question to you is, there has been an uptick in the number of women in parliaments of many African countries. Where have women made the most gains, and where have there been losses, so to speak?
Perhaps I can start. A number of African countries have been on a kind of fast track in relation to women's political representation. And this is due to the adoption of quota. And some of the countries with the most women in politics is South Africa and Rwanda. But it is, of course, an important question to think about whether that has actually led to any form of gender transformation, or it could just be described as a kind of gender washing or gender branding. When you think about Rwanda as a semi-authoritarian regime, and also the need to brand itself only for donors and to kind of hide the poor record in terms of human rights. And in terms of South Africa, research demonstrates that there's some form of state capture and some kind of slave politics, even though there is this zebra-list system where there's an alternation between female and male candidates. There's the whole questions on how to get on these lists. And there are some political gatekeepers who demand loyalty towards the party, perhaps at the expense on a focus on gender equality.
If I may add.
Please go ahead.
Just adding to Diana's point, because of course one of the countries under discussion today is Kenya. We've also seen a significant rise in the number of women at both county, especially at the county level government across the 47 counties. And of course, if you're thinking, or we are discussing just purely descriptive representation, that there has been a significant increase, especially considering that they must adhere to the minimum requirement of having at least a third of the parliamentarians as women. So purely on descriptive statistics, also Kenya has also seen an increase in the number of women in political positions.
Okay, thank you. Diana, you mentioned already a gender quota here, and let's stay with that subject for a while before we move on. More than half of Africa's countries use quota systems to promote gender balance. And this is a question to all of you. Do you think the quota system in general is a useful tool for achieving gender balance? Maybe we should start with Manditsa.
Thank you very much, Henrik. I'd say, well, evidently, there's been a notable progress which witnessed a surge in the number of women's participation in politics during the past two decades. Zimbabwe has not done so well and has been very erratic, as you mentioned earlier on in the previous election. We had just about 14% of the candidates that succeeded being women. And you also notice the recycling of the same women that also have a patronage to the male elites of the parties that are in Zimbabwe. And I think even when you look at for Zimbabwe, though progress has been made in this respect, Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has pointed out that we still have a very low uptake of female politicians in the Zimbabwean politics, which is a far cry of what at least is expected by the SADC Declaration of 1997, which stipulated that we should have at least 30% of parliamentarians being women by 2005. And though we have quota systems in Zimbabwe, they have not yielded much in terms of gains for women in politics because of, maybe let me say, obvious reasons like the cultural issues that are patriarchal in Zimbabwe, which remains a major challenge within the local power structures and make it next to impossible for women to compete for political power.
Let's have also some reasoning from the gender quota from Ghanaian and Kenyan perspective. Maybe Sheila.
Yes. Well, just to go back to your question of how effective the gender quota or the rules on having a quota for women, because, I mean, that's basically what it is if you're being realistic in the context of that we are describing here. I would say it's somehow a double-edged sword because it is necessary because the reality and the circumstances surrounding the participation of women in politics necessitated the legislative quotas because then all other efforts didn't seem to bear fruit. So in this regard, then, yeah, gender quotas have been very instrumental in ensuring that we've got more women in political positions. But then at the same time, and also tying it to the issue that Manditsa has pointed out on the patriarchal nature of our societies, then it's the gender, this quota system has created this atmosphere where then people feel like, well, we are getting these women into these positions just because we need to have women in these positions. It's not that these women are competent to take on these positions or deserve or must take these political positions because they are equal members of the society. So it's brought about this also negative gender politics of, oh yeah, now we need them just because it's the current discourse, it's the right thing to do, it's all within the parameters of political correctness, which points to a big gap which continues to be a problem all even to the success of these gender quotas. The lack of proper and very clearly disseminated civic education about citizenship and political rights and gender equality in general, because then for as long as this continues to lack, because it has proven not to be there, especially in the case of Kenya, where the Electoral Commission has failed to actually carry out these civic education exercises in good time and in proper manner. And by proper manner here, I'm talking about using the languages that many people understand, because we are a country that speak more than 40 different languages. So when you have information only available in English and also maybe just the basic, you could say, if you could term it as basic translation into Swahili, which is the other national language, lacking, then you're basically locking a lot of people or a large proportion of the population from accessing information and creating awareness. And in this regard, then opening up the public to, you know, a positive perception of the background and the goals of these gender quotas.
Thank you, Sheila. And before we move on to the next question, also just from Ghana, in Ghana, there is not yet a legislation in place about gender quota, but there has been a long debate in parliament with a bill. Could you explain a bit more about the opinions pro and con and against, Hannah?
Yes, it has been since 2011, where there was a revision of a 1998 directive, which was not implemented, that there has been this debate about introducing an affirmative action bill. But there has been a lot of back and forth within the different bureaucratic institutions with this bill. And it seems like that there's not really the political will to adopt this bill. It is quite sidelined in terms of the political discussions, even though the women's organizations have organized themselves into an affirmative action coalition and try very actively to lobby for it. In Ghana, there's only 14.6% of women in parliament, so it's a very low number. But where there is some degree of quota in Ghana is actually at the level of the district assemblies, where there is the rule that 30% of those in the restricted assemblies are appointed. And it has been the kind of general rule that 50% of those are kind of reserved for women. But what also happens is that when we have these few women in district assemblies, they are kind of ridiculed as women without a constituency. And also we see at the local level how women are kind of confined to specific places, both in terms of these appointments, but also in terms of positions as women's organizers.
Very interesting. Women MPs in Africa must go through a lot to reach the halls of power. According to a 2021 study by the Inter-Parliamentary Union, IPU, and the African Parliamentary Union, APU, 80% of them have experienced psychological violence in parliament, 67% have been subjected to sexist behavior or remarks, and 39% have faced sexual violence. Disturbingly, the main perpetrators of this violence are their male counterparts. Why does this continue to be the case? And do you think it has an effect on the number of women entering politics on the continent?
If I can start, I mean, I believe that it has a huge effect. And actually, there are also some numbers to document it already now. There is an organization called the Gender Center for Empowering Development in Ghana who has made a report stating that 72% of the women have been exposed to verbal violence, 41% to emotional or psychological violence, and 29% exposed to sexual violence, and 14% exposed to physical violence. And related to that, the report also talks a bit about the effects of this violence against women in politics in terms of low self-esteem, also in terms of depression, and 96% talks about that they become more disinterested in politics. So that's a very high number. I wanted to add that I think it's important to make a division between the kind of, I don't know if you can say, general everyday violence against women in politics and then the gendered effects of electoral violence. In relation to the latter, we have a new research project, Making Politics Safer, Gender and Violence and Electoral Temporalities, coming up.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the research, Diana?
Yeah, it's a relative new project, but we've already started with some preliminary findings from the Ghanaian context and the subnational level in two specific settings where there have been episodes of electoral violence. And there we can see that these women in politics, they account of not only these forms of violence that I mentioned, but also a type of economic violence targeting their businesses and so on. They are exposed to levels of threats and intimidation, not only from their fellow male politicians, but also more broadly from parties, but also from people in the constituency, etc. So it's more like multidirectional type of violence.
Sheila, do you have anything to add, or Mandiza?
Yes, I would just like to, like what Diana captures it very, very, very well. And I would just like to add on this issue of when we, because generally when we discuss gendered electoral violence, it gives off the impression of the violence being confined to this period of campaigning and, you know, actually seeking political votes. But then the reality is that Diana has pointed out the forms of violence that then women are subjected to actually continue to take place. Like, it does not end once these women either get elected or lose out on these positions. It follows them. Like, those who actually get into political positions, these forms of violence follow them into what you would call political corridors of power, if I could just put it that way. And I would just like to point out the other something that has happened in Kenya recently, because we have one of the youngest MPs to be elected, a woman. And, you know, just it's as part of the ongoing political discussion after Raila lost the elections, and she made a comment that maybe it's time for him to retire from politics, because for as long as she can remember, ever since she was born, Raila has always been in politics, always been in opposition. So maybe it's time, like, he took a step back and let other people, younger people, take on power. And of course, this was not taken very lightly by members of the opposition. But then just to show you just how much this violence continues to show how much women continue to like deal with these instances of violence, a fellow MP, of course, a man in this case, was like, you know, in very, very derogatively was said, or rather responded to her that, you know, she needs to know how politics are played in Kenya. She needs to know how to behave herself. And if not, he can deal with her. And, you know, it's the deal with her that is very, what's what I'm looking for, sexist, you know. It's like, I wish I could translate it, because this was said in a Swahili context where, you know, you have to see the hidden meaning behind his "I will deal with her." You know, the point, it has this sexist and these undertones of sexual violence, you know, like I can put her in her place, you know. And this is a fellow legislator, you know. This trend also being portrayed in the way male legislators respond to women's efforts at promoting what you would call pro-women agenda, again pointing to a recent case of one of our MPs, senator, she showed up to the house in a white suit but with red stains, because she's pushing for free sanitary towels for school going children, and the male MPs were offended that that's not good behavior, it's not appropriate behavior, that's not how a political person or a politician or a political representative should present themselves. That's appropriate, not appropriate, but acceptable code of conduct, you know, for women legislators. Like, they should come into this space and recognize that it is dominated by men, and they should actually conduct themselves in a way that does not make men uncomfortable or does not push them away and bring them as women into the center stage. Otherwise, there are going to be repercussions.
So, Diana, you already touched a bit on the importance of NGOs. You mentioned the NGO collecting data on electoral violence against women. Much could be said about civil society, and civil society plays an important role in eradicating violence against women in politics. And from your research from Ghana, Zimbabwe, and Kenya, what can you say about what these civil society organizations are doing? Maybe Manditsa to go first.
Number of organizations that have been doing work, I will not be able to say all of them because they are quite a lot, and I've just outlined them. And one of them would be the Women's Academy for Political Excellence in Zimbabwe. These have been very active in terms of trying to empower women and leadership to advance in terms of knowledge and capacity building for female politicians, which I think remains key. And I think you also know the Women in Politics Support Unit in Zimbabwe, which has been doing work since 2003. And in 2003, they actually ran a campaign which was called Vote for a Woman to Increase Female Representation. While these have been very crucial and active, like I said, there are so many issues that are at play at the moment in Zimbabwe, despite all these efforts. Because generally, the regime has tended to be very repressive and quite discouraging for women. And therefore, even organizations, civil organizations that are working with women are skeptical, because there are always threats of them being shut down if they do anything that is very political and may not be in line of what is acceptable to the ruling party at the moment. Some of the organizations that have been active would include the Zimbabwe Gender Commission, which is also aligned to the government per se, which is pushing for 50-50 gender balance, looking at the previous where we recorded very few women in politics due to a number of factors, and violence, like I said, is one of them, and also just the general knowledge of what is expected or what the constitution stipulates about women in decision making, which a number of these organizations have been working on now to try to capacitate women so that they also really participate. Some of them would include Women's Institute for Leadership Development, Gender Links, and they've done quite a lot at the moment. And I think in terms of international organizations working in Zimbabwe, UN Women and its associated organizations have also been on the ground now to try and teach female politicians and also help particularly the youth, the girls that want to be in politics in terms of what they are up against and how they can really equip themselves so that they become part of the public service in terms of politics in Zimbabwe.
Thank you, Maritza. And Diana, in Ghana, what's the situation for civil society organizations and how is their maneuvering space?
I would say that their maneuvering space is quite high, probably also higher than in Zimbabwe. There are organizations like the one I mentioned earlier, Gender Center for Empowering Development, which has a specific focus actually on young women in politics. So they are doing quite a lot of awareness raising, both offline and online. And they are also doing candidate training, which is an important aspect as well. And then they do kind of advocacy and lobbying. And interestingly, it's not only to promote the affirmative action bill, but they also have a focus on a sexual harassment bill in terms of politics is also a kind of working space. So that kind of policies also need to be introduced. There's also an organization called Abantu for Development, which is the host of the Affirmative Action Coalition. That's a kind of umbrella organization bringing together a lot of organizations and individuals who advocate for the adoption of this affirmative action bill in Ghana. But it seems to be a very long process to get that adopted. But for those countries who do not have quota, they actually do see quota as the solution towards increasing women's political representation and to contributing something very important. Meanwhile, we have these mixed experiences from those countries who have actually already adopted the quota. So that's a kind of paradox.
And Sheila, the situation in Kenya when it comes to civil society organizations?
We also have a lot of organizations on board in helping women with training on how to hold campaigns, how to communicate their agenda. And we've got a lot, of course, there are a lot of foreign-funded organizations like USAID and the Heinrich Boll Stiftung. We have a lot of local initiatives. Well, I think the most well-known is the Maendeleo Wanawake. But I would just like to point out the incredible work that FIDA, the Federation of Women Lawyers in Kenya, has always been doing. I think they had a similar program, like I remember Mandy has mentioned for Zimbabwe, the Vote Adada, Vote Assista campaign, they had that as well. But what I found, and I believe has been very instrumental in helping women navigate the political space, is that they actually set, well, not offices per se, but systems to help women in addressing legal issues that were coming up in their campaign period, especially contesting unfair political party practices, because we had a lot of these cases where women were let out during the nomination process. You had women being left out of the ballot, even though internally they had gone through all the processes and presented their candidacy, and then ending up not being in the ballot, or winning primaries and then having that taken away from them and given to a woman, given to a man. So that was something that was really helpful in the last year's elections, that they set up this what we could call them legal camps or stations to actually help women navigate this. And this, I believe, is also a very important aspect in helping to get more women into political positions, or rightfully get into political positions, because you have a lot of cases where within political parties, they just get thrown out or get unfair deals or just get kicked out in a manner that blocks them from actually getting to the public to sell their agenda and present their candidacy. And that's something that FIDA managed to do very well. And that helped, because then, of course, when parties are aware that there's FIDA on standby to help women, sort out these issues that come out from unfair political party practices, then they ensure that they at least do their best to give a fair chance to both male and female candidates.
Quite. It's remarkable, the resilience of these women politicians and these organizations, of course. So our next question for you is, what is happening on the candidate stage? Are more women running for political office on the national or the local level? Diana, would you like to begin?
Yes. In terms of numbers, there are definitely more women running at the local levels, but generally, there's a lot fewer women running as candidates at both levels. In terms of the national level, in the last elections, there was 126 female candidates against 914 male candidates. So that's a difference. But when we turn to the local level, there was 70,601 male candidates and 909 female candidates. So that's a huge difference. And I do feel that it's important also to focus on the local level, because it kind of feeds in to the national level in terms of who are kind of interested in politics. So it often starts at the local level. So there's a kind of need to kind of groom some of these women in politics at the local level. But I think what we have discussed earlier also, that politics is a rather hostile and misogynist space for women in politics. But it will be interesting to see what happens in the local election in Ghana this year at the end of the year.
And what about the situations in Kenya and Zimbabwe?
For Kenya, what has become increasingly clear is that under devolution, because then now there's more opportunities for women to get into more elective positions, because then you have, you know, under devolution, many more offices that need to be occupied. So generally speaking, this has brought more women into the political front. So you have the face of politics is changing, in the sense that then women are increasingly seeing as active political actors. But now the problem we have experienced, and I would be curious to know how the situation is like in Ghana and Zimbabwe, is that within political parties, you have this habit of having, you know, boardroom arrangements, for lack of a better way of putting it. And especially looking at the county level, at the county government level, because unlike at the national level in Kenya, the constitution is very clear that the county assembly must nominate as many women as is required to meet the two-thirds gender principle. This same, or rather a similar law, is not available for the national parliament, which is why it continues to be uneven. I mean, the gender quota remains unmet. When looking at the county government assemblies, then there's a gender quota requirement. Sorry, the gender quota requirement is met at that level. But then what happens is that precisely because of this call for nomination, for the nomination of as many women, the constitution does not say many women, it says as many members as is necessary to meet the gender quota. What happens is that then political parties sort of talk women into not actively contesting, but with the promise of getting these nominated positions. So women step back and allow their male counterparts to contest. So a male ends up being elected, because then they have been promised, then of course, when we do this, we know the county assembly will not reach the gender, will not be in respect of the gender quota. So you will be given this nominated position. And that's the kind of politics that plays at the local level. At the national level, something also happened with the last elections, where we had these two major coalitions, is that we have women who've been very active in politics. And here we have the likes of Charity Ngilu, who, like Mother Karua, has been very active in Kenyan politics and has even contested for a presidential position. And she did not vie for any political position because of the promise that when her coalition got into power, then she would get a certain appointment. So you have these arrangements where then women continue to be sidelined based on promises that are made or are given to them, that you step down now, so, you know, for your male counterpart, and in other cases, it's even a relative. And then when we go in, we give you a position, you see. And this sets a very dangerous precedent, because then the whole reason we want more women in politics is not just for the sake of descriptive representation, but it's because we actually want systems where policies pay respect to the realities of the gender issues in society. So if we have such arrangements, then we are really going many steps backwards in actually trying to have, if I may just call it, feminist policymaking. And that's, I think, a very dangerous path or a very dangerous prospect into looking at the future of women in politics, especially in the Kenyan context.
And now, yes, please go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to add that for Zimbabwe, like I said earlier on, the situation has been very erratic, with the previous election probably being the worst in terms of having women at both levels incorporated into politics. I would say the current situation is that there are more women at the local level, while very few women are at national level. But you find a very familiar pattern for Zimbabwe, particularly within the ZANU-PF party, where they, like Sheila said, boardroom arrangements, or let me say something that is predetermined. And these women are usually relegated to spaces that are considered typically female. Like, for instance, Sekai Nzenza, the Minister of Public Service and Social Welfare, and who's the Women's Affairs and Community. I mean, these are offices, or let me say ministries, that are associated with women, which are usually softer. And this is where you find most women situated in, as far as Zimbabwe is concerned.
And thank you very much. This is a very interesting topic, and we could go on forever and ever and talk about it, but our time is unfortunately up. So thank you very much, Diana, Sheila, and Manditsa, for your participation. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.